Much of the nation's attention has been focused, and rightfully so, in my opinion, this past week, on the Louisiana gubernatorial elections. For those of you who eventually hear this program on tape, yesterday, November 16, 1991, former, unquote, Ku Klux Klansman and Nazi David Duke was defeated in his bid to become the governor of Louisiana. He did wage a relatively successful campaign, in my opinion, certainly projected himself onto the national stage to a greater extent than he already has, but at least for the time being, his electoral successes his electoral bids have been unsuccessful. We're going to take a look at David Duke, take a look at the phenomenon of fascism and Nazism, and we're going to take a look in particular, as we move through this section of the broadcast, at David Duke's probable connections to elements of U.S. intelligence. Before we do that, though, I'd like to read a portion of a story which came out this past week. This is from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, November 15th of 1991. This is an AP story, Dateline New York, headlined, "A Scheme to Sell Out England to Hitler Told." It's subheaded, "The Duke of Windsor reportedly thought Hitler a great leader." By the way, it's not reportedly, it's a matter of public record that the Duke of Windsor was pro-Hitler. The book, "Who Financed Hitler?" by James and Suzanne Poole, Dial Press 78. There's a book called King's X. There's a book called "Who Killed Sir Harry Oakes?" And those are three books that talk about the Duke of Windsor's open and recorded Nazi sympathies. This particular story talks about efforts on behalf of the Duke of Windsor to sell Germany out, or sell England out, I should say, to Germany during the Second World War. It reads in part as follows. In December 1940, with German bombs raining on his cities, Britain's Duke of Windsor tried to enlist President Roosevelt to sell out his country to Hitler. The custodian of 50-year-old interview notes said Thursday, the Duke, who 4 years earlier had abdicated as King of England to marry a divorced American woman, is said to have made the overture to author Fulton Ursler, O-U-R-S-L-E-R, who was interviewing him for Liberty magazine. Ursler's notes say the plan was for Roosevelt to offer to intervene for peace between England and Germany. The Duke, still enormously popular in his beleaguered nation, would immediately support the idea in terms that would touch off a revolution in Britain. During the interview with the former Edward VIII, Ursula brought up speculation that Hitler might be overthrown by Germans in the wake of Italian defeats in Greece. Ursula's notes say the Duke, quote, said there was too much wishful thinking, that there would be no revolution in Germany, and it would be a tragic thing for the world if Hitler were overthrown. Hitler, he said, was the right and logical leader of the German people. He regarded Hitler as a great man, unquote. Well, one of the main elements in the first two Radio Free America shows, in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, in the Uncle Sam and Il Duce broadcast, in Radio Free America number 10, and the miscellaneous archive show about Japanese fascism, all of which are available from archives on audio, is that many of the world's top industrialists and financiers and many of the world's most influential people were openly pro-fascist. They saw fascism as an antidote to what they perceived as the threat of world communism, and so they openly embraced it. The sympathies of the Duke of Windsor for Adolf Hitler are symptomatic of that, and we should note in this context that many of this country's top industrialists and financiers were once again openly pro-fascist and pro-Nazi, and many of the same interests that supported Adolf Hitler very actively, not only politically but economically, as witnessed in some of the above-mentioned archive shows, are still very much on the scene today. Well, just as the Duke of Windsor was openly pro-Hitler, David Duke, our Duke, was also openly pro-Hitler, and information about that was carried in that very same edition of the San Jose Mercury News, namely the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, November 15th of 1991. I'm going to read you a section of an article by Carl M. Cannon of the Mercury News Washington Bureau, Dateline New Orleans, headlined, "Duke Admired Hitler's Tactics, Blasted Jews in 86 Interview." This is about David Duke, our Duke, whose sympathies are very similar to the Duke that I just read you about. Skipping down in the story, asked if he believes Jews should be, quote, exterminated, unquote, Duke says he is opposed to killing people in masses, unquote, but says, again quoting, Jewish people have been a blight, unquote, and that they, again quoting, deserve to go into the ash bin of history, unquote. I think the best thing, Duke adds, is to resettle them someplace where they can't exploit others, unquote. Later, Duke cautions Fields, interrupting, that's Joe Fields, a fellow Nazi and white supremacist. Later, Duke cautions Fields against openly advocating Nazism, quote, of course, I'm on a different tactic, unquote, Duke says, and again quoting, I'm trying to bring people in like a drummer. The difference is, if they can call you a Nazi and make it stick, tough, really hard, it's going to hurt the ability of people to open their minds to what you're saying. It's going to hurt your ability to communicate with them, unquote. Fields replies that most people aren't going to come over, quote unquote, until times are economically tough. That last sentence again, because it's a key. Fields replies that most people aren't going to, quote, come over, unquote, until times are economically tough. Continuing, finally, the tape has a chilling sequence in which Fields says, quote, it doesn't take that many people, though, to start something rolling. Hitler started with 7 men. That's what I'm trying to say to you, Duke replies. And most people didn't want to have anything to do with him, Fields says. Right, answers Duke. And don't you think it can happen now if you put the right package together? Don't you think there are millions of Americans that are alienated and looking for something? Not necessarily me, somebody. My God, I might have to do it because nobody else might come along to do it. Well, note here a couple of things as we're going to be getting into this a little later. Note that David Duke is saying that we should be able, that is to say, he and his fellow Nazis should be able to do something like what Hitler did. Joe Field says that most people won't come over, quote-unquote, until times are economically tough. And note that it says that Hitler started with 7 men, because we're going to come back to that later in the broadcast. Well, times are economically tough, and it should be noted for the record that it was the social dislocation produced both by the runaway German inflation of the early 1920s and the Great Depression, which was far more severe in Germany than even in the United States, that drove many of the German people into the arms of Hitler and made them much more receptive to Hitler's message. It should be noted that, again, Hitler had the support of many of Germany's top industrialists and financiers, as well as those of the of other countries, as I've noted. And it should also be noted that many of the Nazi leaders in their private writings were quite candid about the fact that it was not the Jews who were responsible for Germany's economic problems, but it was necessary to scapegoat somebody, and that that's why the Nazis were using anti-Semitism in the strategic political way that they were. I would note also that the scapegoating of poor people and people of color in particular in this country for America's economic problems has been a major element in the Reagan, Bush, Nixon, and Ford and generally right-wing Republican agenda. When Ronald Reagan says, well, we've got to hold down government spending, he is lying in his teeth because Ronald Reagan is the world's greatest government spender. Ronald Reagan spent 2.5 times as much as all of the previous presidents in American history put together. He turned the United States from the world's biggest creditor nation, which we had been since the end of World War I up until 1980, and he basically spent more than any president ever had. And yet, Ronald Reagan continued to be able to say that even up to the end of his 8-year term, because basically it was well understood in middle America that what he was really saying is, let's get those blacks and those Mexicans and Puerto Ricans off of welfare who were spending our hard-earned tax dollars on their shiftless, lazy situations. That basically, and it's a theme that has been sounded by George Bush and was sounded by Richard Nixon, George Wallace, Gerald Ford, is the same basic thing that David Duke has been saying. It should be noted that poor people, and in particular people of color, people on welfare, quote-unquote, are already being scapegoated for America's economic problems, and it is my fear that if those economic problems worsen, and I would be willing to bet they do, then the degree of scapegoating is also likely to worsen. I don't think we can rule out a final solution to the Negro problem, quote-unquote, in this country in the event of a desperate economic collapse. It should be noted that this country, in addition to having become the world's biggest debtor nation and owing more money than all of the third world countries combined, this country's savings and loan industry is already bankrupt. The bailout may come to more than $1 trillion. The commercial banks are in terrible shape. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is $9 billion in the red. Just this past week, a bill to bail it out was rejected by Congress. It should be noted that the insurance companies are also in very bad shape, just as bad as the commercial banks. I mention that because most money market funds are privately insured, therefore they're not safe either. There is enormous corporate debt from the leverage buyouts and go-go financing of the 1980s. Last but most assuredly not least, there is also enormous consumer debt, and this against the deindustrialization of America. America is losing its industrial base not only due to the capturing of previous Americanly dominated markets by Japanese and European industrial interests, but also by the flight of industry to other countries, in particular American manufacturers, moving key manufacturing facilities to the third world and then to the south, primarily to the third world, to take advantage of the cheaper labor costs there. I think that in the event of an economic collapse, and I'm afraid one is coming, we may very well see people like David Duke, not necessarily Duke proper, but people like him coming to the fore and their drastic solutions gaining widespread acceptance. In fact, take note of Joe Field's prediction that economically tough times will be needed before people come over, and then consider the following. This article appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, November 13th of 1991. It's from the Gallup organization, the polls, pollsters. It's Dateline Princeton, New Jersey headline, "Despite disliking Duke, many favor his views." Poll finds support for dropping busing, and quote as it reads in part as follows. Despite strong personal disapproval for Louisiana gubernatorial nominee David Duke, many Americans express support for many of the campaign themes he has been promoting in his bid for office. A new Gallup poll shows that a majority of Americans favor many elements of Duke's populist, anti-government platform, including across-the-board reductions in all government agencies, taxes and fees, elimination of such practices as busing and quotas, and requiring welfare recipients to work for their welfare checks. The Gallup poll tested elements of Duke's current campaign statements taken from recent interviews and speeches. These were not directly identified with Duke in the survey and were read to respondents before any specific questions about Duke were asked. Many of Duke's more extreme racist and neo-Nazi statements were made in earlier years and are not now an official or overt part of his campaign. The results? 79% of Americans favor Duke's position that all able-bodied welfare recipients, including women with children, must work in order to collect welfare checks. 76% support Duke's position against giving blacks preference over equally qualified whites to make up for past discrimination against blacks. 73% favor the death penalty, which Duke supports. 67% of Americans favor Duke's blanket promise to reduce the size and budget of all government agencies except law enforcement. Almost as many, 65%, favor an across-the-board reduction in all income and sales taxes as advocated by Duke. 58% favor Duke's position of opposition to busing in order to achieve racial balance. So David Duke, although people may not like the explicit identification of Duke with Nazism and Ku Klux Klan activities, David Duke's views and David Duke as a political animal are obviously things that, at least if we can believe this particular poll, are gaining acceptance with the American people. I would note, too, that the social dislocation produced by Germany's severe economic problems, as I've already indicated, were one of the things that caused the German people to lose faith in the leaders of the Weimar Republic. Hitler was able to succeed not only because the German military, underground formations of the German military, systematically assassinated the legitimate political leadership of Weimar Germany, as we looked at in Radio Free America 10, plus a miscellaneous archive show dealing with that assassination program called the FEMA. This is something which, in my opinion, corresponds directly to the wave of political assassination which plagued this country in the late 60s and early 1970s. But beyond that, simply because of the inability of the leaders of the Weimar Republic to deal with Germany's economic problems, the German people were ready for a change. They lost faith in their political leadership. I would take note of that as we read a column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Friday, November 1st of 1991. This is a column by Anthony Lewis of the New York Times. And I would note that this is Dateline Boston and headlined, "Duke Vote Reflects Loss of Faith in Nation's Leaders," a familiar historical note, one which we saw in Weimar Germany. When a former Ku Klux Klan leader and neo-Nazi has a good chance to be elected governor of American state, it is time to think about what is wrong in the politics of this country. David Duke came a close second in the Louisiana gubernatorial primary, finishing just 2 percentage points behind Edwin Edwards, the former governor. Because it happened in Louisiana, there was a certain tendency to put it down as another example of that state's eccentricity. But it is not a joke. The Duke phenomenon is extremely serious, and its implications are not confined to Louisiana. The votes for him were a cry of political resentment, a cry that I think was aroused by economic pain manipulated by the factor of race. Millions of Americans, many millions, are suffering from a prolonged and devastating economic recession. Real wages have fallen for 3 straight years. Unemployment has hit not only wage earners, but many middle-class people, and there is no convincing sign of a meaningful recovery. The physical conditions of life are becoming more and more unpleasant for Americans. Highways are crowded and crumbling, and cities are unable to cope with the homeless, schools, and myriad other problems. Even medical care is priced out of the reach of many ordinary people. 60% of those reached in a New York Times CBS poll released last week said things had got, quote, pretty seriously off on the wrong track, unquote, in this country. They said the most important problem was the economy. Yet President Bush offers no program for economic recovery or reconstruction. He says essentially that nothing can be done. In the circumstances, an historian would expect political repercussions, would have expected them indeed before now. And here they are in the vote for David Duke. It is the vote of people who have lost faith in established political leaders. Bush's spokesmen tried to distance themselves from Duke. He was not a real Republican, they said. But Duke has remodeled himself in the image of the contemporary Republican Party. Not so long ago, in the 1980s, he celebrated Adolf Hitler's birthday and told an interviewer that the Nazi death camps had been built not to kill Jews, but to kill lice that infested Jews. But he has muted that kind of talk, and he has remade his face by plastic surgery. Nowadays, Duke talks to his political audiences about affirmative action, quotas, quote-unquote, welfare abuse, and crime. The same rhetoric has been used by Bush and his people. It can be, it often is, a genteel code to evoke anti-black feelings. One lesson of the Duke phenomenon is that when national leaders use race for short-term political gain, as Bush has repeatedly done, the country is likely to pay a price. I would note, too, that even though George Bush officially condemns David Duke, George Bush himself is noted to have had a number of Nazi sympathizers and fascist Eastern European collaborators on his Republican Ethnic Heritage Council. I took a look at that in a miscellaneous archive show called Nazis and Anti-Semites on the George Bush Campaign. It's also covered in the book Blowback, not the Bush Campaign, but the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council, the book Blowback by Christopher Simpson. There's also a book called Old Nazis, The New Right in the Republican Party, put out by Political Research Associates, authored by a Detroit researcher named Russ Ballant, last name B-E-L-L-A-N-T. I would note also that Anthony Lewis had a follow-up to that column from the Chronicle of November 1st of 1991. This one was in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, November 13th. Of 1991. This also was datelined Boston, and it's headlined, "It Can Happen Here, and It's Happening Now." I watched David Duke on NBC's Meet the Press, and I was frightened. Here was a man who 2 years ago was selling Nazi pamphlets from his office in the Louisiana legislature. Now he was a candidate for governor with a good chance to win, and he was talking blandly about the trouble with welfare and affirmative action. If the politics of hatred is going to take power in America at the end of the 20th century, that is the form in which it will come. Not rabble-rousing, but cold words and professions of Christian redemption. "I'm a Christian person," he says. "I have regret over the intolerant things I've said," unquote. He made his celebration of Hitler, his hatred of Jews and blacks, his leadership of the Ku Klux Klan all seem long ago and far away, as if they had to do with someone else who had inhabited his body. Quote, "I was 19 years old," unquote, he explained at one point. But in 1989, when he was 39, he spoke admiringly of Josef Mengele, the Nazi doctor who conducted grisly experiments on Jewish and other inmates at Auschwitz. He called Mengele a genius, unquote. In 1985, he said of the Holocaust, quote, "I tend to believe it didn't happen. It takes Jewish Hollywood to make crematoria, and it takes Jewish Hollywood to make crematoria into, quote, ovens," unquote. In the 1980s, he formed the National Association for the Advancement of White People and edited its newspaper. In it, he said, quote, "Rapes resulting from street abduction and break-ins are a plague intrinsically associated with blacks," unquote. He said again, quoting, "Jews are not good Americans. They have no understanding of what America is," unquote. How could such a person become a serious political force in the United States? How could anyone believe his pious assertions that his years of professional hate were, quote, youthful indiscretion, unquote? Part of the answer has to lie in the economic distress that people in Louisiana have been suffering. They are angry, and like many other Americans, they are looking for new leadership outside established political circles. But there are also racial feelings, white hostility to blacks. References to welfare and affirmative action tap into those feelings. David Duke did not invent the technique of code words. He did not make Willie Horton an issue in 1988 or invent the issue of quotas to obstruct a civil rights bill for 2 years. Bush is evidently beginning to regret using the racial issue. Immediately after the Louisiana primary, his people said the state now had two bad choices for governor. But last week, Bush forthrightly called Duke a charlatan and said he would vote if he could for the opposing candidate, Edwin Edwards. I would interrupt, note that George Bush poo-pooed the presence of documented Nazi and fascist collaborators on his own campaign in 88. Continuing. Are the people of Louisiana endorsing Nazism if they choose David Duke or give him a large vote? Of course not. Many will just be expressing frustration, ignorant of the real Duke and his beliefs. But they will not all be ignorant. I would add that the same could have been said of the German people who endorsed Hitler. Continuing. A candidate for governor who lost in the primary, Mayor Sam Jones of Franklin, Louisiana, took part in candidate forums with Duke. After one of them, a Duke supporter came up to Jones and asked him, quote, how would you feel about a constitutional amendment to exterminate Jews, unquote. Nor is the Duke phenomenon something that we can reassure ourselves is confined to Louisiana. I had a letter the other day from a man in Hyde Park, New York, that said in part, quote, I am a white male, part of the 99% which Duke represents. We are Christians and America firsters. Understand that college-educated people like myself are aware that we need true outsiders to come in and join the political process. Politicians like Duke also answer the deepest anger we have with race quotas and welfare mothers, where whatever their race, who spawn bastards to be paid for by taxpayers. Remember the Central Park jogger and her attackers? Unquote. On Meet the Press, Timothy Russert, R-U-S-S-E-R-T, NBC's Washington bureau chief, asked David Duke, what was there about this country that made you a Nazi? Unquote. He got no answer. After this Saturday's election in Louisiana, many of us may be wondering what voters think has gone wrong in this country. Well, David Duke, I suspect largely because of the fear that Louisiana would lose convention business and other forms of economic largesse, has been turned back for the time being, but I would not discount David Duke and others like him as a potent political force in the future. In fact, I'm afraid that force is likely to become more potent as time goes on. The last article I read before a musical break, and then we're going to come back with some tapes, all comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, November 4th of 1991. This is an article by Jua Nyla Hutchinson, H-U-T-C-H-E-S-O-N, of Reuters at Stateline, New Orleans, headline, How David Duke Earns His Money. Subheaded, To Say I've Never Held a Job is a Cheap Shot, unquote. It reads in part, David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan wizard David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan wizard who could be elected governor of Louisiana, has made his living as a fundraiser for himself. Duke's opponents say he has never held a real job, but the Republican candidate for governor defends his action as the epitome of the American entrepreneurial spirit. Quote, I am self-employed, and there is certainly nothing improper or illegal about that, unquote, he said in an interview. Again, quoting, To say that I've never held a job is a cheap shot, unquote. Well, I would add that to say David Duke has never held a job is, I don't know about a cheap shot, but it certainly is inaccurate because there is abundant evidence that David Duke may very well have been working in some capacity for some U.S. intelligence agency or perhaps more than one. This has an ominous parallel in history because Adolf Hitler himself, as we will see later in the broadcast, got his start in German government life as an undercover informant for the political department of the Reichswehr, the German army, under General von Lossow. That last name is L-O-S-S-O-W. We're going to examine David Duke's probable activities on behalf of U.S. intelligence and the ominous comparison with Adolf Hitler's functioning in the same capacity on behalf of the German national security establishment after a musical break. Before the break, we concluded by taking a look at the charge that's been made against David Duke that he has never held down a job. Well, I'd have to say that that's David Duke's denial that he's never held a job is one of the very, very few things, in fact, the only thing I can think off the top of my head that I agree with David Duke about. I also think that it is wrong, although not necessarily unfair, to talk about David Duke never having held down a job because there is abundant indication that David Duke has indeed held down a job. Specifically, there are ominous indications that David Duke may very well have been functioning for quite some time in some capacity alongside of, or actually for, U.S. intelligence agencies, or at least one or perhaps more. As I've indicated, and as we're going to hear, this bears an ominous parallel with Adolf Hitler, who also got his start in government life as an undercover agent for the political department of the German army, the Reichswehr. What we're going to do now is we're going to study some of David Duke's political resume. Specifically, we're going to hear some information from Radio Free America program number 13, the fourth and concluding broadcast in my four-part Radio Free America series about the Aryan Nations. This program was recorded in December of 1983, and in turn, it accesses heavily, and you will begin hearing one of my old Hard Rain shows that was produced in late 1983, a good 8 years ago. I have seen Gruppenführer Duke coming for a long time, and frankly, this is in no way to boast. I sincerely wish I was wrong about a lot of these things, but I saw Duke coming a long time ago, and so I began doing research on him and accessing information about him, because I think he's an extremely dangerous individual, and the most ominous and dangerous thing about him is his apparent work on behalf of U.S. intelligence. We're going to begin by hearing this section of Radio Free America 13, which in turn accesses directly my old Hard Rain show from late 1983. And also later on in this particular tape segment, you will be hearing the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air duties. So we're going to proceed now with a segment from Radio Free America 13. We're going to continue on to the next cassette, and we're going to hear some more taped information later about Duke and Adolf Hitler. So those of you who are taping, please get your tapes rolling right now. Here is Radio Free America number 13.
Now, the first thing we're going to look at in connection with Duke today is his activities while a student at Louisiana State University. While at LSU, Duke apparently devoted a good deal of his extracurricular time to promoting white supremacy, and one of the things that he did in this regard was to found an organization called the White Youth Alliance. Its name pretty much implies what it is. It's a young white supremacist, young fascist organization, and this organization was founded by Duke, as I said, while he was a student. And one of the things that's interesting is his White Youth Alliance is apparently very closely intertwined in a number of ways with an organization called the National Socialist White People's Party. Now, that is an American Nazi party which grew out of American Nazi Party Führer George Lincoln Rockwell's organization. Now, in the past, specifically last week, we took a look at the connections between George Lincoln Rockwell and Lee Harvey Oswald, and also a New York Klan leader named Daniel Burroughs. And we also took a look at the fact that not only was George Lincoln Rockwell then assassinated, but Daniel Burroughs committed suicide with three bullets. Now, after Rockwell's assassination, his organization metamorphosed into the National Socialist White People's Party. And in 1970, the National Socialist Bulletin, the publication, the newsletter of the NSWPP, basically focused quite heavily on David Duke's activities, talking about him as a Nazi leader at LSU or in Louisiana. And interestingly enough, in some of his publications done in connection with some of his publishing done in connection with the White Youth Alliance, David Duke quoted verbatim from the NSWPP publication. And a still more interesting connection between the two organizations, that is the NSWPP and David Duke's White Youth Alliance, concerns the fact that David Duke gave the mailing address for one of his White Youth Alliance programs as basically an Arlington, Virginia mailing address, which was also the mailing address of the NSWPP, the National Socialist White People's Party. So apparently there is some fairly close but poorly defined link between Duke and the NSWPP, the organization that grew out of Rockwell's Nazi Party. Now, for all of our information on Duke in this program, we're going to be relying on a book that we've dealt with in the past and relied on very heavily in the first two programs in the Klan series. That book is entitled, appropriately enough, The Klan. It was authored by Patsy Sims, last name S-I-M as in Mary S, and was published in softcover by Scarborough Books. It was copyrighted in 1978, and Patsy Sims, the author, is a former reporter not only with the San Francisco Chronicle and the New Orleans State's Item, but she also wrote with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and we quoted from the Inquirer last week. So Sims, a veteran and well-traveled reporter, and her book, The Klan, is one of the best, if not the best, books on the subject, in my opinion. At any rate, of David Duke and his connections with, that is to say, the connections between his White Youth Alliance and the National Socialist White People's Party, Patsy Sims writes as follows. The The National Socialist Bulletin, official publication of the National Socialist White People's Party and edited for a time by Duke Lieutenant Jim Warner, took note of Duke's activities in Louisiana. One item in the August 1, 1970 issue referred to, quote, local National Socialists led by Dave Duke, a student at Louisiana State University. That fall, a special edition of the White Youth Alliance's Racialist included a white power program, unquote, in which Duke, under his own byline, copied verbatim passages from the already published Goals and Objectives of the NSWPP. The back page carried a boxed coupon captioned, Membership Application for the White Student Alliance, 2507 North Franklin Road, Arlington, Virginia, 22201. The address of the National Socialist White People's Party. So again, when Duke gave a mailing address for his White Youth Alliance, it was the same as that for the American Nazi Party, the NSWPP. Now, interestingly enough, also while at Louisiana State, David Duke apparently took on, according to his own statement, he served a hitch with the Agency for International Development. And specifically what he did for AID was to teach English to Laotian soldiers over in Vientiane, the capital of Laos. Now, Patsy Sims describes David Duke's alleged activities on behalf of AID as follows. The university degree and his physical appearance were not all that set him apart from the rough-hewn Knight Rider image usually associated with the infamous KKK initials. Articulate, charming, and sexy, Duke was boyishly sophisticated, his vocabulary encompassing gosh and golly and vis-a-vis, his accent worldly. The son of an engineer, Duke was born in Tulsa, attended kindergarten in The Hague, and a private military school in Georgia, and had lived in sundry other places before his parents moved to New Orleans in the early 60s. He interrupted his college studies, he said, to spend a part of 1971 in Vientiane teaching English to Laotian army officers in what he described as, quote, a special government program, unquote, conducted by the State Department's Agency for International Development. Now, interestingly enough, the CIA has often used AID, the Agency for International Development, as a front. And interestingly enough, the CIA has admitted using AID as a front in Laos, where Duke maintains he was. Now, one of the most interesting things about David Duke concerns the fact that he apparently has elicited suspicions in a great many quarters that he is, in fact, an agent for the government, and specifically a CIA agent. Now, Patsy Sims discusses Duke's apparent or alleged activities on behalf of the government in her book, The Klan. Now, the first section that we're going to deal with of her discussion of Duke's possible activities as an agent concerns her interview with a detective who had apparently been monitoring the Klan for 2 years and various other right-wing groups for a total of six. Now, he maintains that David Duke, or he believes that David Duke is CIA. He cites his activity teaching in Laos on behalf of AID, the fact that his father served with the State Department, which we're going to talk about in a second, and he thinks that his anti-Jewish attitudes would be desirable from a certain standpoint, that would be the State Department would regard them as desirable because that could be useful in promoting relations with certain anti-Zionist Arab factions. Okay, so that's one reason that this particular detective felt that the CIA might want a Klan leader. That is to say, want one of their agents to become a Klan leader. Now, Patsy Sims described this in the Klan as follows. But I pondered even more the possibility that he was an agent for somebody. At his Baton Rouge home, he had scoffed when I confronted him with insinuations made by Shelton and other Klan leaders. That goes back to some sort of weird thought process where they say, he's getting on national television and he's hitting him so hard and so forth, he can't really be doing this. He can't be getting away with this. He must be working for the enemy. Because they themselves have been failures in their own approach, unquote. Earlier in my travels, a detective who had monitored right-wing groups for 6 years, the last two assigned exclusively to the Klan, had offered his own theories. There are two ways to look at David Duke. Either he has been working for somebody for an awfully long time, or he's making money. Look at David as being CIA. He taught in Laos. His father is with the State Department. David being associated with right-wing groups, he's anti-Jewish. any anti-Jewish propaganda would be supported by an Arab faction. So consequently, an Arab faction may want to talk to David in order to keep the fires burning on the Jews. It's hypothetical, but he travels a lot more than what we think his expenses would allow him to. And he's just been around so long. Of course, looking for people who apparently have no apparent means of funding is one thing one looks for in examining for a possible intelligence agent. And the fact that apparently Duke did a lot more traveling than he appeared to be able to afford was one of the things that elicited this particular detective's suspicion. Now, another thing that this detective found very interesting was the fact that David Duke was the one Klan leader that the government never asked for information on. This covered by Patsy Sims in the Klan as follows. Also, the detective continued, another very, very good reason that makes me think David is working for somebody is that none of the federal agencies have ever come to us for information on him. Everybody else they do, but not for him. They don't ask us for Klan information. On the other hand, 95% of the FBI information on the left comes from local law enforcement. This is only theory, he cautioned, but... Well, next, Patsy Sims describes her own reasons for suspecting David Duke as an agent. First of all, the fact that he always seemed to turn up at all of the hot spots where possible racial confrontations could occur. The fact that he apparently got around a great deal, apparently one time was in Washington 10 times in the space of a single year. Also, he at one point showed Patsy Sims a debugging device that, according to Duke, had been given to him by a government friend. He also at one point... forged an alleged attack manual instructing blacks on how to kill white people under the pen name of Muhammad X, he said, in order to keep track of enemies of the white race. And one of the most interesting details that Patsy Sims cites in maintaining that David Duke may have been a government agent is the fact that when he went to England, London, the British Customs attempted to bar David Duke from entering the country. He got in anyway, evading British Customs, and then continued to evade Scotland Yard, who were trying to arrest and deport him. So apparently David Duke on his own was able to evade not only British Customs, but also Scotland Yard, which is no mean feat for a private citizen, particularly in a foreign country. Now, of Patsy Sims' reason for suspecting Duke as an agent, she writes as follows. I had my own reasons for suspecting Duke's role as an agent. He popped up everywhere, in places the government would want someone on the inside. Boston and Louisville during the busing demonstrations, the Marine Corps infiltrations, taking on the illegal trafficking of aliens at the Mexican border, meeting nationally and internationally with other right-wingers. He was in the Washington area at least 10 times in the course of a year. Once, when I met him at his motel, he showed me what looked like a small block of wood, explaining that it was a bug detector a government friend, unquote, had given him, and walked around the room to test it. I speculated the agent role could possibly explain an attack, unquote, manual on how to kill white people that he surreptitiously wrote under the pseudonym of Muhammad X, in order, he insisted, when confronted by the New York Times in early 1978, to compile a list of blacks involved in racist activities against white people, unquote. It could also explain how he managed to slip past London Customs in March of 1978, after the British government had banned entry by him and other Klan leaders, play hide-and-seek with Scotland Yard when it attempted to find and deport him. Again, no mean feat for a private citizen. Now, when Patsy Sims attempted to run down from the government information on Duke's possible role as a government agent, and specifically his work for AID, or alleged work for AID, she was unable to... positively verified that Duke was a government agent. She did, however, get sort of what I guess one could describe as a government, as a standard runaround. She describes that as follows. Obtaining information on him, that is to say Duke, obtaining information on him from the government proved impossible. Duke repeatedly claimed he could remember neither the name of the teaching program in Laos, nor of his supervisor, and suggested I call the State Department or its Agency for International Development or its Agency for International Development. For days, my calls were transferred from department to department in both the State Department and the USAID. No one could remember such a program. People who had been in Vientiane in 1971, the time Duke supposedly taught there, could not recollect anyone by his name or description. I then tried the Pentagon and various branches of the military and again came up with nothing. When Hodding Carter III was named Deputy Press Secretary for the State Department, I renewed my efforts, hopeful another journalist could help. Carter returned my initial call within 15 minutes, even though he had been in his job less than 2 weeks. He sounded anxious to help and asked me to put my request in writing. A year later, the letter, written February 3rd, 1977, had not been answered, nor were subsequent phone calls to Carter. So again, she was unable to get anything positive about David Duke's work for the U.S. government. It's worth noting here that one of the detective's reasons for suspecting Duke's possible role as a, what he believed, as CIA agent, concerned the fact that his father worked for the State Department. His father also served in the military, and Patsy Sims describes her father, David Duke's father, rather, as follows. She visited him at one point. On my way back east, I stopped in Washington to meet Duke's father. Aside from gray hair and a slight Midwestern flavor to his voice, the elder Duke looked and sounded remarkably like the youthful Klan leader, especially as the private meeting at Fort Myers at the Fort Myers Officers Club darkened with the day and the father's views surfaced. A graduate of the University of Kansas and a retired colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, he had been employed as an engineer for 25 years by Shell Oil Company, and for the past 10 by the U.S. State Department, mostly in Southeast Asia, overseeing the planning and construction of hospitals and schools for the Vietnamese government. Back in this country less than 2 years, he had followed his son's careers in letters from home, and the military's Stars and Stripes. Worth noting here that much of the KKK activity in the military, particularly in the Marine Corps, was carried on behalf or by David Duke's Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. So that is undoubtedly how his name appeared in Stars and Stripes here. Now, it's worth noting here that David Duke's father's views on race apparently were not all that far from his son's. And Patsy Sims, in this very same conversation with her father that she refers to, with the Duke's father, rather, that she refers to, gives us a little insight into how David Duke's father sees the issue of race in the Klan. She writes as follows. The father described his relationship with his son as close. They often talked by phone, usually about the family or general politics, never about the Klan, he insisted. Nevertheless, he took stock both of his son's accomplishments and the need for his work. A good old school teacher one time said, the white Americans and the Europeans have over 5,000 years of cultural development, and these people are three and four generations out of being completely heathen savages. How can we expect them to compete and come in and develop and be everything we are, to live in our society and be together in our society? Or he's got a point, right or fair. The father shrugged. I'm not anti-black. I'm just trying to talk facts. Unquote. I'd like to wind things up here with a description of a David Duke parade and cross-lighting here, at least the parade. This preceded a cross-lighting, a cross-burning, I should say. And keep in mind the possibility that David Duke is a government agent as you listen to this description of his organization in action. At first it was quiet, and just the rhythmic right-left of the marchers' footsteps. Then the shouts exploded into the Sunday morning quiet like rounds from a machine gun, slamming back and forth again and again across Decatur Street until the echoes dissolved into a silence as deafening as the shouts. A hoarse male voice led the litany. What do we want? White power. What do we got? White power. White power. White power. One more time. White power. Each round grew louder, more piercing, more frightening, with children and women, even Chloe Duke, slinging their voices into the verbal barrage. Only Dutton and his partners marched stoically, neither chanting nor, like the others, extending their left arms in Nazi-type salutes. The three stared straight ahead, oblivious to the motorcycle police escorts, wide-eyed tourists, and tittering blacks. One small girl, robed like the rest, clung to her father's hand, her face reflecting none of the arrogance of the other marchers. In spite of the humid September heat, the child and a man on crutches kept up as the block-long parade turned onto Canal Street.